chapter 5, very familiar passage of Scripture. We'll read the first 15 verses, John chapter 5. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus, because of this feast, went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem, by the sheep market, a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these, that is, these five porches, lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. And a certain man was there, which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie, and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? The impotent man answered him, Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool. But while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Jesus said unto him, Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, took up his bed, and walked, and on the same day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, It is a Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. He answered them, He that made me whole, the same said unto me, Take up thy bed and walk. Then asked they him, What man is it that said, which said unto thee, Take up thy bed and walk? And he that was healed wist not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. Afterward Jesus findeth him in the temple, and said unto him, Behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. Now, John is the only one of the four gospel writers who records this particular event. It is one of seven miracles recorded that took place on the Sabbath day. It is the record of Jesus coming to and healing a man who had been lame for 38 years. We don't know how old the man was. All we know is he had been lame for 38 years. He might have been 80 years old. He might have been 38 years old. We don't know. That doesn't really matter. He was lame for 38 years. And this, of course, is the historical record. It's an actual event. It was an actual occurrence, something that really happened. Happened on a particular day, at a particular time, in a particular place, to a particular individual. It is the record of a miraculous, life-changing event. And everything about it is real. But it's more than just a historical record of miracle. The Lord has chosen, of course, to preserve it in His Word. And it typifies and it illustrates the greatest and the most magnificent of all miracles. That, of course, being the salvation of a sinner. But what is recorded here is recorded to teach us and to preach to us and to convey to us the truth of the salvation of helpless sinners, that their salvation is found only in Jesus Christ. We want to take the main thought from what this healed man said to the Jews, who said to him, "It is the Sabbath day, it is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed." And he replied in verse 11, "He that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk." And in those words, we see grace and obedience linked. And they are linked all through the Word of God. Now, obedience cannot be the cause of grace, because then it would no longer be grace. But obedience is the result of grace. And the two are linked. No matter how hard man tries to disconnect them, they are linked. So we want to speak on this subject, grace and obedience. We want to consider, first of all, the gracious miracle that took place here, the healing of this man. Again, it occurred on a Sabbath day. The place of the miracle is Jerusalem. Verses 1 and 2, we see it was at a pool called Bethesda. It is also recorded in verse 2 that this pool was by the sheep market, or the sheep gate. This is the gate through which sacrificial animals were brought to the temple, and it would have been just north of the temple. It is also recorded in verse 2 that around this pool were five porches, or five covered places, protection from the heat of the day and the elements. It is also recorded that in these porches, there in verse 3, these five porches, lay a great multitude of impotent folk. A great multitude. Doesn't tell us how many. It would have been too hard to count, and therefore they just say a great multitude. And all of these people that were in these porches, this multitude, were a great multitude of impotent or weak, feeble, disabled by disease individuals. Then he goes on and he mentions the different maladies that were present. There were those that were blind. There were those that were halt. That is, they were lame or crippled in some way. There are those that were withered, speaking of paralysis. So these are an ailing people. These are a debilitated people by disease. Now we see in verse 3 what they were doing. They were waiting for the moving or the stirring of the water. This was their life. This was their life. They congregated. Some of them perhaps stayed there all the time in these five porches. And they would spend their day waiting for the stirring of the water. So their life is very limited. Their life is very, very restricted. The unsaved sinner doesn't believe it, but their life is very limited. Their life is a life of great restriction. Now, the reason that they are waiting at this pool is given in verse 4. There was an angel that went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. And whoever was able to get into that pool, whether he had someone help them or crawl or whatever, that individual would be healed. So they wait at this pool. It is a picture of individuals that are desperate, waiting, spending their day waiting for the stirring of the water. Very sad, very pitiful scene. This great multitude laying in these five porches, of course, portray fallen and unsaved man and his lost and ruined condition. This multitude laying in these five porches are representative of the fact that unsaved man is disabled as a result of sin, and they are powerless to save themselves. So you get the picture of this multitude of people. There's a pool of water, and these individuals are scattered in five different covered places nearby the pool. Jesus then arrives on the scene, and he does so for a certain individual. Now, many would have you to believe that Jesus arrived on the scene for everyone in that multitude that day. Well, if that is so, then he miserably failed that day, because there was only one that was healed. He arrived at the scene for one man. He is simply referred to as a certain man. Verse 5. A certain man. Not even told his name. Jesus knew his name. Jesus knew all about him. But for you and I, he's just referred to as a certain man. And this man, we're told something about him. He had an infirmity. That is, he had a disability of some kind. And he had this disability for 38 years. He is referred to in verse 7 as the impotent man. In other words, he's crippled, cannot walk, paralyzed. He was so feeble, so weak, that he was absolutely powerless and unable to put himself in that pool. He was an invalid. He was a crippled, unable to stand, unable to walk. And he had been this way for 38 years. And Jesus comes to this place among this multitude of sick, diseased, very frail and infirm and weak and blind and paralyzed and crippled individuals. But he came to bring healing to this certain man. He was there for this particular individual. Now Jesus went to this certain man. The man didn't come to him. Jesus went to this certain man, not because of anything in him. He had nothing to offer, just like you and I. But he went to him simply because of grace. And the fact that Jesus went to this man is a picture of Jesus choosing him. Why didn't he go to anyone else? He chose this man. He chose to go to this individual. John records in verse 6, when Jesus saw him, lie. And I believe Jesus looked on him with purpose, with intent, with an intention to heal him. Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been in this, that he had been now a long time in that case. That is, in that situation, in that state of affairs, in those circumstances. So Jesus comes, and Jesus sets his eyes upon this one individual. Now to do so, he no doubt walked past many others. But he was there for this one individual. So it was when you and I were saved. Jesus Christ came to where we were. And he may have walked past many individuals. But he came right to where we were. So what we see here is Jesus coming to and caring for a particular sinner. Jesus knew everything there was to know about this man. Yet Jesus reached out to him anyway. That's grace. He literally and in person came to where this man was to bless him, to fix him. That's grace. When Jesus Christ comes to bless, we're undeserving. When he comes to fix our lives, that's always grace. Always. In the account, Jesus personally and directly dealt with this man. Jesus speaks to this man. He's dealing one-on-one with this man. That's what happens when the Lord saves a soul. He deals one-on-one with the sinner. The one who could bring life to this, to his withered limbs, the one who could bring healing to his life, had come to him. And we see him ministering to him. Notice verse 6. When Jesus saw him lie, and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he said unto him. Now who's taking the initiative? Well, Jesus saw him. It doesn't say that this man saw Jesus. Jesus saw him. Who spoke first? Jesus did. He takes the initiative. He said unto him, wilt thou be made whole? Now the purpose of the question, Jesus never asks a question for information's sake because he knows all things. But he asks a question for our own benefit. And he asks this question to cause this man to realize, but more importantly, to acknowledge his condition. Before the Lord saves a sinner, they are always brought to the acknowledgement, to the realization and the acknowledgement of their condition. In verse 7, the man answers. The impotent man answered him, sir, he has no idea who he's speaking to. No idea whatsoever. Sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool. But while I'm coming, another steppeth down before me. He didn't answer the question. The answer to the question was a yes or no answer. Wilt thou be made whole? It's either yes or no. He didn't answer the question. He gave an answer, but he didn't answer the question. But what his answer did reveal, it revealed the helplessness of this individual. I have no man. In other words, I can't get in the pool myself, and I have no one to help me. So he acknowledges the helplessness of his condition. That was the purpose of the question. He acknowledges his need. Does he not also express disappointment? I have no man. And while I am coming, when I am trying to make my way to the water, someone else steps in before me. In other words, he had experienced this time and time again. His life is one of helplessness. His life is one of great need. His life is one of disappointment. But is there not also a sense of hopelessness? I mean, after a while, you do that enough times, you just give up. And this is the condition of this man. So, though he did not answer the question, his answer did serve the purpose of him acknowledging his condition. And again, before the Lord saves a sinner, the sinner is always brought to see and to feel the hopeless condition that they are in. That's grace. When the Lord brings an individual to acknowledge their need, to acknowledge their condition, that's grace that does that. Jesus then commanded the man to do three things that he could not do. He told him to do three things that this man could not do. Verse 8, Jesus said unto him, rise. That's one thing. Take up thy bed. He was to rise first. And then he was to bend down and pick up his bed or his cot. He was to rise. Secondly, he was to take up his bed. And then holding that bed, he is now to walk. Three things that he could not do. Jesus said to this man, who was powerless, stand up, bend down and pick up your bed, and walk. The man could do none of these things in and of himself. Then notice verse 9. And immediately, the man was made whole. That's what happened first. So important. And immediately, the man was made whole. Notice, it's not that he rose, he took up his bed, and then he was made whole. That's not what it is. The man was made whole before anything else happened. Jesus healed this individual. The man was made whole. Did he make himself whole? No. This was an action that was performed upon him. It was the power of God working upon him. Did this man just will himself whole? Well, if he did, why didn't he do it before? The man was made whole by the power of the Lord. As a result of being made whole, he was able to stand. As a result of being made whole, he stands, and as a result of being made whole, he was able to bend down and pick up his bed and walk. But the standing, the taking up his bed, and the walking are the result of he was made whole. God had done a work upon this man's life. This man's life was now changed. Everything's different. This is grace. Again, some would have you to believe that the man just willed himself to be made whole, that he willed himself to walk, but that's not the case at all. He was made whole by an outside power. He was made whole by an outside power. His life was changed. This is a beautiful figure and type and illustration of what God does in the miracle of salvation. And again, I remind you, this is a real and literal event. He was literally made whole. This is not something he dreamed about. This is not something that he imagined in his mind. This literally happened. He was made whole. He experienced this in his life. And being made whole, it had a life-altering impact upon him. Now notice the effect of this miracle upon this man. His way of living is now changed. And it is changed in a very manifest way. It is changed in a way that others could not help but notice. In verse 10, the Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, it is the Sabbath day. It's not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. That is on the Sabbath day. So others saw. This man's no longer sitting by the pool. He's walking around. He's carrying his bed. They can see a difference. He's no longer laid on his bed at the pool called Bethesda, waiting for the moving of the water. His life is no longer identified by that. His life is no longer identified by the pool, by Bethesda, or waiting. That is now not the identity of his life. But now, he's walking. He's walking, and he's carrying his bed. Do you picture this man walking around carrying his bed, has dejected, sad, long face? I don't think so. He's experienced a life-altering change. And he's thrilled. He's happy. Carrying his bed. No longer laying on that bed. An act of grace has taken place. And there's a difference in his life. Now notice in verse 11. He answered them, "He that made me whole." Does he not realize that he was made whole? He who made me whole. He didn't say, you know, I was just sitting there and all of a sudden I just thought, you know what, I don't want to be this way anymore, and I just got up and walked. I just willed it to be so. That's not what happened. And so it is with the lost sinner. You don't just will yourself saved one day. The Lord comes to where you are and saves your soul. He said, "He that made me whole." I didn't do this myself. He made me whole. In those words, is there not a sense of gratitude? He that made me whole. He realized that he did not make himself whole. He realized this was not my own doing. He that made me whole. And he's grateful. I mean, if someone heals you, someone impacts your life in a positive way, there's gratitude. This man doesn't take any credit whatsoever. He that made me whole. He doesn't say, the one that my uncle sent or my grandfather sent or my mother prayed for me. That's not what he says. He that made me whole. He realizes he owes a debt of gratitude to this individual. But notice also, he felt that what Jesus had done in his life was grounds for obeying what he told him to do. Verse 11 again. He answered them, "He that made me whole, the same, that is the very one who made me whole, said unto me, take up thy bed and walk." In other words, what else could I do? He who made me whole told me to do this. And that is the only grounds that I need for doing it. He who was gracious to me told me to rise and to take up my bed and walk. And basically what he said, I don't care if it's a Sabbath or not. Don't you understand? He that made me whole told me to do this. He was simply obeying the one who had been gracious to him. And this made perfect sense to him. This was very reasonable to him. He recognized Christ's authority in his life. And that was reason enough to obey him. He left no room for his own opinion. He that made me whole, the same said unto me, rise, take up thy bed and walk. Left no room for his own opinion. Left no room for his own thoughts. Or the opinion and thoughts of the very ones who were questioning him. He made no room for his plans or his ways or the plans and ways of those who were questioning him. But as soon as Jesus said, rise, take up thy bed and walk, without delay, without considering circumstances, cost, or outcome, he obeyed the Lord. Why? Because this is the one who made me whole. And he told me to do this, and that's the only reason I need. And so it is today. For those who have been saved by God's grace, you need no other reason to obey God. You don't need anyone else's opinion. You don't need anyone else's thought. The one who came to you in grace says, do this, don't do that. That's reason enough. We need no other reason. It's that simple. And I do believe that if this saving grace is real, we have no problem obeying the one who was so gracious to us. So you see, grace and obedience go together. Obedience is the result. He felt an obligation toward the one who healed him. He that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk. This man made him whole. So he felt duty bound to this individual, to Jesus Christ. And if the Lord has saved our soul, then we ought to feel duty bound to obey him. He felt a responsibility. He who made me whole, the same, that very same individual, told me to do this. He felt a responsibility to do what Christ said. He felt obliged to do it. He felt a constraint. It was like he couldn't help himself. He felt a constraint to obey. Now what Christ said to this man in verse 8, rise, take up thy bed and walk, it wasn't mere advice. It wasn't simply a command. It was a command, but it was more than that. It was a word that was full of power. It was just as when the Lord said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Again, when Christ came to this man and said, "Rise," he did rise. And the reason he rose is because he was made whole. Those stagnant blood vessels felt the lifeblood stir and flow, and those dormant nerves were suddenly aroused, and those withered sinews and muscles felt energetic action, and the result was, before the man even knew what he was doing, he stood up because of a power that was working in him. And carrying his bed and walking was just part of the cure. It was the result of the cure. Not only was it the result of the cure, it was proof of the cure. Now picture this man who had been healed. If he would have got up, picked up his bed, walked 5 or 10 steps and then sat back under the covered porch and just spent the rest of his life waiting at the pool. But every time someone would come by, he'd go, "Hey, you know, the Lord healed me." Really? I don't see any difference. That's what a lot of people want us to believe today. Hey, the Lord saved me, and there's no difference in their life than there was before. Now, you'd have to be a complete fool to believe them. Just like you wouldn't believe this man who'd been there for 38 years, if he continued to live his life that way, you're not going to believe that he was healed. The fact that he is walking and carrying his bed was proof. This man had been cured. This man had been healed. And I don't believe that this man ever went back to that porch to spend a night there just to relive old times. I don't think that happened. I don't think he had any desire. Why would you go back to that lifestyle when you can walk? Why would you go back there? It's a good question for those who profess salvation and their life is no different. This man who was healed due to the marvelous grace of the Lord was motivated to carry his bed and walk. Grace motivated him. And it motivates us, too, that are saved. There was a power in him that moved him, that inspired him, that propelled him, that drove him to do what Christ said. And then from his answer in verse 11, it was as if there wasn't anything else I could do. Nothing else even crossed my mind. The Lord said, "Do it," and I did it. That's the way it ought to be. That's the way it ought to be. So this miraculous grace of God changed this man's life outwardly. And he's now walking and carrying his bed. He's doing it in an unquestioning manner, and he's doing it willingly. He felt great joy in doing what Christ told him to do. You see this man walking and carrying his bed. Do you think that was grievous to him? "Oh, the Lord cured me. Oh, the Lord cured me." And just so sad, as if it was a tragedy to have in his life. That's the way a lot of people act. They want you to believe that the Lord saved them, and they act as if it's the worst thing that ever happened to them. They don't know anything of the saving grace of God. This man walked around with great joy. And it was not grievous to him to walk. And it was not grievous to him to carry his bed. And I believe each step he took carrying that bed, the thrill became greater. and the joy became greater. And yet today, there are people who want you to believe that the longer you're saved, the more miserable life becomes. Well, you better look into your salvation. You better really, truly examine it. Because salvation does not make your life miserable. And it does not make your life grievous. He also had a desire to worship. Notice verse 14. They asked him, "Who was it that healed you? What is his name?" And he said, "Well, I don't know his name. Because he left so quickly because of all the people." Verse 14. Afterward, Jesus findeth him in the temple. How did he get there? He walked there carrying his bed. This man had been cured. His life had been changed. And where did he go? He went to the house of God to worship. Realizing that what Christ had done in his life, though he did not know it was Christ, he, with gratitude and humility and with great joy, went into the temple to thank the Lord for making a difference in his life. Notice verse 14 again. And Jesus findeth him in the temple and saith unto him. He went into the temple, and what happened? He met Jesus. He met him again. That's what happens when we go into the house of the Lord. And what else happened? Jesus revealed himself more fully to him. This is obvious because it says in verse 15, the man departed. He left the temple and told the Jews, "You want to know who it was that healed me? You want to know his name? It was Jesus." How did he know that? Well, obviously, Jesus told him when he was in the temple. Jesus further revealed himself to this man. So now, you have this man is healed. He doesn't know much, but he's happy. He goes into the temple to worship. He meets with Jesus. He learns more about Jesus. And when he left that temple, guess what? He was happier than he was before. And that's how it works. So I'm sorry, I don't buy it, that the longer you're saved, the more miserable you become. Don't buy it. Don't buy what you're trying to sell. The greater the joy becomes. Because you learn more about Jesus. And the more you learn about Jesus, the less grievous it becomes. It's not a heavy burden to serve God. It's a joy. But notice in closing, verse 15, the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus. He couldn't wait to tell them. He couldn't wait to tell them. Because he wanted to exalt the one who healed him, he told others. When the Lord saves a soul, they can't help it. They got to tell others. Someone says, "Well, I've been saved for 10 years, but I've never told anybody." I doubt that seriously. Not that you haven't told anybody. I doubt seriously that you've been saved. Doubt it seriously. I mean, if you find a $10 bill on the sidewalk, you tell somebody, "Oh man, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. I found $10. And you're going to tell me the Lord saves your soul and you don't tell anybody? I'm sorry, I don't believe it. I'm not an idiot. I wasn't born yesterday. I don't believe it. Don't believe it." He went and he told others. It was Jesus that made me whole. So again, read verse 11. "He that made me whole the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk. Here we are in a world opposed to Christ. And this is to be our attitude and our response. Why do you live differently? Why do you do that? Why don't you do that? Because the one who made me whole told me not to go there. Told me to do this. That's the only reason you need. You need no other reason. We live in a world when the commands of God go against the thoughts of man. Your family will think you're absolutely nuts if you obey the Lord. Most of those who profess to be God's people will think you're nuts. But you do it because the one who saved your soul told you to. That's the only reason you need. And that ought to be our explanation. Why do you do that? Because the one who saved my soul would not be pleased if I did otherwise. They're not going to understand that, but that's the reason. That's the reason. Live in a world when the commands of God do not seem pertinent to a lost world, and they don't even seem to be pertinent to most who profess salvation. But to those who are truly saved by the grace of God, he that made me whole, the same said unto me. In other words, he made me whole, and whatever he says is pertinent. Whatever he says is true. So, oh, that we might live our life, in verse 11, he that made me whole, the same said unto me. You know, man's nature has not changed. Paul, in the book of Romans, lays out the subject of salvation by grace. And as he was doing so, he knew that he would meet the arguments of man. Why, if it's by grace, then you can live like you want, you can sin all you want, just say, I'm sorry, Lord, forgive me. That's still the attitude of man. That's still the attitude of many so-called saved individuals. But Paul addressed that in Romans 6, and we'll close verses 1 and 2. He said, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. Grace never encourages anyone to sin. And if an individual feels comfortable in sinning, they have every reason to question if grace has ever been real in their life. Grace leads to obedience. Grace causes us to want to obey the Lord. My dad used to say all the time, well, if I believe like you do, I would just go out and live like the devil, knowing that I'm going to go to heaven anyway. But you see, that's carnal man thinking. That's lost man thinking. That's someone thinking who doesn't understand what grace does within you. It takes away that attitude. It takes away that attitude, and that individual wants to obey God. Not to keep saved. We don't have to keep ourselves saved. The Lord does that. But because he saved us, we want to serve him. We want to obey him. And everything we do, because of the one who's been so gracious to us, it ought to cross our mind, does this please the Lord? Does this please the Lord? And that's really all that matters. It doesn't matter if everyone else is doing it. Would it please God if I did it? And if it doesn't, then you and I have no business doing whatever it is. And if it pleases God, that's the only reason we need to obey him. The ones who grace is real in their life They're not always looking for loopholes to get around obedience. Amen. People who do that, once again, you have to seriously question. Do they even know anything about grace? Because I find that attitude contrary to grace all through the Word of God. Oh, how grateful we ought to be for the saving grace of the Lord. Brother Jim, if you'd come.